Welcome, everybody. This is the third lecture, Entrepreneurship and Competition and Saving an Investment, two important topics packed into one lecture. For the Mises Academy online class, Principles of Economics, this is the spring 2012 edition of the class, and it's May 2nd, 2012. Again, always time-stamping this for those of you who discover these lectures after the zombie apocalypse. So what we're going over today, like I say, is entrepreneurship and competition first, and then we'll get into saving an investment. Okay, so entrepreneurship is something that free market economists stress more often than interventionist economists, or I guess you could just say mainstream economists, certainly New Keynesian economists, but it's also something that even within free market circles, I think the Austrian school has an advantage in, that this is something that Austrian economists really stress. So like I said in the beginning of this course, this is a Principles of Economics course, and everything I say in here is going to be very consistent with Austrian economics, but this is actually more of a big tent thing, right? So I wrote the textbook Lessons for the Young Economist with a broader audience in mind. I wanted to write something that any homeschooling parent could use who was skeptical of big government and, you know, believed in the principles of the founding fathers, you know, that kind of stuff. I wasn't trying to make it really sectarian and say, oh, we're Austrians and we don't like the Chicago school. That wasn't my aim. But I'm just letting you guys know that in terms of economic theory, it just so happens that the Austrian economists, I think, have done the most important work on entrepreneurship. And so this is a gaping hole in the mainstream approach to economics. And if you go on in college and certainly to grad school and you take formal economics courses, I think this is one of the areas where you'll see that there is a real problem. That what ends up happening is these models that mainstream economists who are not Austrians, these models they have of the economy, there's really no role for the entrepreneur. All right, so they might talk a little bit about it in the beginning of the course, but then, you know, you get into drawing the diagrams and you get into like reasons for government intervention fixing so-called market failures, and especially if you get into stuff like antitrust regulation and things like that and what they call perfect competition, you'll see that there's really no role for what Austrians think entrepreneurs actually do. All right, so in this diagram or this slide, you know, you've got Rockefeller, you guys probably recognize Bill Gates. You've got another, I'm drawing a blank. Does anyone know who this guy is? I'll frame it like it's a question. Hey, class, who's this guy? He's a so-called robber baron, but I forget if that's Vanderbilt or if it's, I'm pretty sure it's Vanderbilt, but I'm not certain. The guy on the top left is Rockefeller, but the guy I'm talking about on the top right there, because I made this slide 2 years ago and I forgot to. I'm pretty sure it's Vanderbilt, yeah. And this is obviously Oprah Winfrey, and of course, our beloved Jeff Tucker. So so what these people are all entrepreneurs in their own respective fields. And so what I'm trying to get you to see here is that entrepreneur does not, it doesn't merely mean somebody who's rich necessarily. It's like, as far as I know, Jeff Tucker's not rich. But it does mean, what do they do? The entrepreneur is the person in the market economy who perceives an opportunity, who realizes, or who thinks he or she realizes, because the entrepreneur could be wrong, but thinks that, you know what, there are customers out there who would pay for a product or a service that I could produce for them or provide to them, and what it would cost me, all things considered, is less than what they would pay me for it. So there's this opportunity that I could go out and hire workers, buy other sorts of inputs, create this product or service and then sell it to willing customers and earn more than I pumped into it, all things considered. You know, you might want to consider also the amount of time you as the entrepreneur would have to put into the project and to figure out is it worth me putting all that much effort. All right, so that's what entrepreneurs do, and you have to realize in a market economy, and this is all elementary stuff, but it's amazing how if you go take an economics class, you know, standard econ 201 or something at a college, you're not going to get this kind of stuff. That a market economy, how do we describe it? There's various ways. They say, oh, it's based on private property, and that's true. But another thing that we stress about a market economy is that there is free entry into various occupations, and that it's what's called a free enterprise system. So what does that mean? It means anybody can start a business. All right, so we know in the real world that businesses are highly regulated, and you can't just go like open up a bank. That the government has all sorts of crazy rules. But the point is, those are all sort of deviations from the pure standard of a free enterprise market economy. And so what is it that characterizes that? It's that the way goods and services get produced is not because some central group figures out, okay, we've got all these resources, we've got all this manpower, and we've got all these people who need to be clothed and fed and housed and entertained and so forth, so how are we going to produce all this stuff, right? The way the market economy solves that problem is through the institution of private property, but also sort of what's embedded within that notion is that people just create businesses, like individuals do it, where they can come together and form partnerships or sell stock and have a corporation, what have you. But the point is, there's no agency that's in charge of saying, you guys go do that, you do that. That people are free to go into business for themselves if they want. And of course, the workers are free to go sell their labor services to whomever they want. All right, so it's the entrepreneur is crucial in a market economy because so what you do for you, trying to think of a, like if a mall was going to open, right, a brand new shopping mall. So first of all, somebody had to decide that piece of land right there. I think there should be a shopping mall right there as opposed to a gas station or as opposed to an office building or as opposed to an apartment building, right? That there is a decision. And so why is it that it's a shopping mall? Well, because a bunch of investors, apparently, presumably looked at their demographics of the area. They looked at where all the other retail outlets were, and they thought it would be profitable if we built a shopping mall here. And so how do they actually do it? They don't plan the whole thing down to the last pretzel vendor. No, the developers of the shopping mall, they might be in talks with the anchor stores and figure out, okay, we're going to have a JCPenney or we're going to have a Belk's or whatever here and here, and we're going to have maybe, a Target down here and so forth. But the point is they rent out the individual stores to the highest bidder often, right? So even there it's very decentralized. So the point is all these little decisions are deferred to particular individual entrepreneurs. And so then how does it all come together? Well, that's the system of profit and loss that I think is we handle it in a different chapter. Okay, but here the reason I'm stressing all these different people here, like Rockefeller, what did he do? Well, he did a lot of stuff, but among other things was he figured out a way to really reduce the price of refined gasoline. Okay, so he brought down the price compared to how other people did, and he did it through all sorts of different ways. And part of it was because he was so got to be so big, eventually he got really good deals on freight costs and stuff like that. All right, so it wasn't. I think people have this notion that the way innovation is involved when it comes to business is if somebody invents something. Like they imagine that Thomas Edison comes up with this new idea. But a lot of times what it is are people who have a way of delivering a given product just a little bit better than the competition. And then when that's magnified over a big enough business, that can have a huge effect. All right, so what it was about these so-called robber barons, and if you haven't ever read it, I highly recommend it's Burton Folsom, and the name of the book is The Myth of the Robber Barons. Okay, so then if you're just listening to the audio, it's Folsom, F-U-L-S-O-M, Burt Folsom, and the name of the book is The Myth of the Robber Barons. It's a little, almost pamphlet-sized booklet, but it's really good. He just goes through the history of these people that we've been taught to sort of, you know, vilify, you know, Rockefeller and Vanderbilt and so on, and Charles Schwab. And he goes, and Folsom goes through and shows, well, the reason they got to be the titans or the captains of industry in their respective fields is that they delivered the products to their customers at lower prices than any of the competitors did, right? That is the crucial, essential feature of capitalism, whatever else you want to say about it, is that the business cannot stick a gun to the head of the customer and take the customer's money. The customer has to voluntarily hand it over. Now, there are certain scenarios where people will say, oh, come on, that's effectively not a free choice, right? Like if you're starving to death, and you're out in the middle of the desert, and there's a vendor selling bottles of water, that's not a very advantageous position for you to be in if you're the guy starving or dying of thirst, excuse me, right? But the point is, if we're talking about capitalism and the voluntary exchange of property rights and property titles, the way the business person gets to be on top, so to speak, or dominates a field is by providing better products at lower prices. And that's the way you capture market share. And so, yes, a lot of these business people are ruthless, and you probably don't want to work around them. But the point is, the reason they have so much so-called power is that they consistently deliver better products at lower prices to their customers. And that's why the customers keep coming back. All right, why don't I move on here. So let's go over some quick definitions here. So revenues, here I just mean the money that the business gets from customers. All right, and by expenses, I mean the money that the business pays for inputs. And then monetary profit or loss is just revenues minus expenses. Okay, so let me just caution you a little bit here. If you go deeper into economics, you can define these terms either in a sort of abstract, subjective way, where you're broadly considering all the benefits of doing something and all the costs, and in which case, you know, something is profitable for you to do if you get an advantage from doing it, right? If you find it useful to do, then you would just say, oh, it's profitable. And so it's sort of just another way of saying people will do the thing that gives them the most happiness or satisfaction. All right, so there is that sense. But here, I think just while we're getting started, it's easier just to think of it in terms of the just focusing on actual flows of money. All right, without worrying so much about the more theoretical, abstract approach. So I'm just, the only reason I'm mentioning this is because some economists are real purists about this, and I don't want you to hear one thing from me, and then you go on and learn hear something else, and you think that there's a contradiction, that different economists might define these things differently. But I think the practical person, when he's talking about a business enterprise, and they say, what were the revenues last quarter, they mean, if I go out and look and count how much money came in, that's what they're talking about. They wouldn't include, like, oh, I really felt great because I made a difference and I provided a bunch of sweatshirts for people in my city. And so in addition to the $80,000 in cash that I took in, I'm going to include, you know, that psychic feeling of joy as part of my revenues, right? I think, you know, business people would say, whoa, 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 what are you talking about, right? So I'm looking at this more like from an accounting standpoint. And that's why number three here, I italicized that word monetary, because I want to make sure there's no confusion that in these chapters right now here, I'm explicitly narrowing the focus to just talk about monetary profits or losses. So having said that now, what can we say? That a business will tend to try to maximize its monetary profits and to avoid monetary losses. And this is sort of, you might think that it's obvious. It's not as obvious if you think it through, because you could have situations where, you know, there's borderline cases. Like, let's say somebody, I think the example I used in the textbook was somebody kind of runs a little league. You know, the kids play baseball, and so somebody actually has a formal business that takes in money. You know, if a kid wants to play baseball, he pays the membership fee, whatever the fee is, and then he gets the uniform, and then the league has to hire people to come be umpires, and has to, like, arrange some, you know, with the park to be able to go play the games there, and so on. And, you know, maybe they have to pay for advertising, or maybe they have to, maybe they take in money from the food vendors and the ice cream vendors who want to set up during the, so there's, you know, money coming in and money going out. And so the person running the little league, you know, probably has to keep some books just to keep track of all this stuff. And it's possible that the person's going to lose money, and maybe he's fine with that. Maybe he's mostly doing it as a hobby, and he wants to keep the prices down so that a lot of kids can participate. And he knows that, well, gee, if I raise the prices so that I would actually make money on this thing, then maybe a lot of kids wouldn't do it, or, you know, maybe just the business model I have here, it actually wouldn't turn a profit. Or what's even more likely is maybe the guy would run the numbers and realize, you know, yeah, I technically turned a monetary profit running this thing last year, and I earned, you know, I took in $1,000 more than I paid out in explicit monetary expenses, but I probably put in $1,000 or 1,000 hours worth of my own time into this league, you know, dealing with parents on the phone and their scheduling conflicts, and I had to call the field and make sure we had it rented out for our tournament last week, and all this stuff. And, oh my gosh, there's going to be a thunderstorm. I better start, they're sending out emails to make sure the parents don't take their kid out there because there's a thunderstorm. I mean, there's a lot of stuff going on to run a league. And so maybe the person realizes, all things considered, I made $1 per hour. So if the person were doing it for the money, that would be a very wasteful use of his time. He could just fold, you know, quit the league, let it fold, and go work at the grocery store bagging groceries and make more than $1 per hour, right? So what I'm saying is, entrepreneurs who are running businesses in the real world are guided by monetary signals, in particular profit and loss signals, but I'm trying to get you to see they won't necessarily just go do the thing that makes the most profit. It's just that's an important element, and they need to be aware of that, but it's not that they're necessarily going to be driven like blind robots to go do whatever they think will earn the most profit. And then also there too, you can start getting into this area and distinguish between something that's a genuine business like a profit-seeking business versus something that's more of a hobby, right? And so there's a gray area there as well. But even within the realm of something that truly is a profit-seeking business, even there, it's not the case that every entrepreneur does that which maximizes profits. So you could be a film studio, right? That you're in the business of making movies, and it's your livelihood, right? You have to earn a decent living there, and maybe you realize you could go earn $30,000 or $40,000 doing something else, working for somebody else. So you have to make at least that much to support your family or whatever. But the point is, you're still going to exercise some creative and artistic influence over the type of movie you make, right? So if you're a pacifist, you're probably not going to make movies glorifying World War II. And if you're a liberal Democrat, you're not going to make a movie praising Richard Nixon. You see what I'm saying? So there's things there. So you're not just going to make movies based on which movie do I think will make us the most money, or the most profit, to be more accurate. There's also an area in there for you to have other considerations. But so that's why I said what we can state with confidence is that there's a tendency for businesses in a market economy, for entrepreneurs to try to seek profits and avoid losses, but there are other influences too. So it's not that that's the only thing going on. Now what, let me just jump ahead 1 second to see. Okay. Let me mention one thing here so I don't want to miss the point. Monetary profits and losses, this is absolutely crucial for, regulating the use of scarce resources. All right, and I'm going to get into this later in the book more explicitly, but here let me just touch on it because it's a crucial point, and so it's fine if we're a little bit repetitive and I say it now and then come back to it later and really underscore it. But what happens, monetary profits and losses, those are not arbitrary. Those are real things. It means something real about the world to say that a particular business is losing money. That's the crucial point here I'm trying to get across to you guys, that someone who's a socialist or even just somebody who doesn't really know much about business or economics might think that a firm's so-called bottom line, right, whether the firm's making money or not, that's typically called the bottom line, or somebody says, uh-oh, we're in the red this quarter. What does that mean? It means we're losing money this quarter, and the quarter meaning a 3-month period within the year, right? So January, February, March is the first quarter, and so on. So that's often how businesses divide time up mentally, as they refer to quarters. And so, if a business person says to his managers, hey, we're in the red this quarter, they mean, oh, we're losing money, so our monetary revenues are less than our expenses, and that's a problem. And so what I'm trying to say is, I think a lot of, for sure, socialists, but even just general people who don't really know that much about business or haven't studied economics very carefully, they think that that is a somewhat arbitrary thing. Like, oh, yeah, that's just a social convention, but it doesn't really mean anything, you know. And then if a particular, a company that makes little shoes for babies, the fact that they're losing money and so they want to change what they're doing and cut back output. You know, let's say, all right, we're losing money, we got to cut back on our production, maybe lay some people off, sell off some of our plants, and so on and really streamline here. And so now we're not producing as many shoes for babies. And so I think a lot of people would look at that and say, see, that's the problem with the market economy, is it's guided by profit and loss decisions and not by what does society really need. And so, this is one of the things that Marxism used to appeal to the masses, or just socialism more generally, was that it seems like, yeah, that's not really right that in a market economy, business decisions are ultimately guided largely by profit and loss. Like, why is it that a bunch of accountants have so much control over what happens in the economy? That doesn't seem right. Why are a bunch of pointy-headed accountants with their figures and so forth? That's not right. You know, we should, instead of dollars and cents, we should be reckoning in terms of what do people need, or what's really important to us as a society in terms of our shared community values, you know, that kind of stuff. So what I'm saying now is that view is very naive, that profit and loss signals really do refer to something real and meaningful. So in particular, what it means if a business is losing money, just look at these definitions. It means that the business is spending money on inputs, you know, how much it pays the workers, how much it pays to the owners of other sorts of natural resources, how much it pays to use capital goods or to buy them outright. That total amount of money that it spends on those inputs and then uses those inputs to make some product or service and then sells it to the customers of the business in total are not paying enough money to the business for it to then turn around and hire all those inputs or buy all those inputs. Okay, so there is a sense in which the business is taking inputs that have a certain market value and transforming them into a product that has a lower market value. And so there is a legitimate sense in which you could say that business is destroying value, not value in the mind of any one person, but value in terms of how does the market appraise the wealth represented by these items, right? So I'm being a little bit sloppy with my language here, but I'm just trying to get the big picture across. So what happens is if a particular – so think of it this way. There's only so many resources to go around, right? There's only so much labor power. There's only so much land. There's only so much aluminum. There's only so much crude oil. And those things could be rearranged and used in almost an infinite number of possible combinations to crank out different types of consumer goods and services. And so how do we decide as a society how those things are, you know, what should we do? Should we make more baby shoes or should we make fewer baby shoes? Should we make more movies or fewer? Should we make more milk or less? The way those problems are solved in practice in a market economy is, hey, if you want to go into the business of making baby shoes, go right ahead. No one's stopping you. But if you consistently lose money, people are going to stop investing in your business. And then if you're the owner using your own capital, eventually you're going to run out of money too. And so that's what's going to make you stop doing it. And so the point is, it's a signal. If you're consistently losing money, the signal is saying, effectively, the consumers would rather spend their money buying stuff other people are making because they're willing to give enough money to those people so that they can turn around and buy the inputs. And that's what's keeping the price of those inputs up. So actually, the prices of these scarce resources protect them. That's the way we make sure as a society that they're not squandered on some silly thing. Because if you think about it, to have free enterprise and to let people pick whatever occupation they want, it almost sounds like, like anarchy in a bad sense. It's just like, well, wait a minute, how could it be that anyone can just do whatever they want? And if you think about it, people back, in the Middle Ages when there was a guild system where if you wanted to be a blacksmith, it would help, like if your dad had been a blacksmith, and he could get you into the guild and you get trained and so on. But it's not just like anybody could just be a blacksmith, right? And those people probably, if you had described to them a society where anybody could go into any occupation and anybody could open any business, they would probably be horrified and say, what if no one wants to be a farmer? Then everyone starves to death. Or what if nobody decides to be a doctor? Then everyone dies from illness. And, you know, what if no one happens to go into being a cobbler? Well, then nobody's shoes get fixed. You see the issue? And so, but, you know, we know, oh, no, don't worry about it because wages would adjust. And if too many people try to go into one area, well, then there wouldn't be much profit there, and so then they would go somewhere else. You see, so we already kind of have an idea of the market's self-regulating pattern, but if you didn't actually grow up in a world like that, it would sound crazy. So that's what I'm trying to stress here, is that what monetary profits and losses do is provide sort of a feedback mechanism so that a business that's consistently losing money stops. You want that firm to go out of business. So I guess that's one way of putting it. I think a lot of people, when they see a business fail and shut down, they're like, oh, that's too bad. That's an unavoidable evil of a market economy. And no, that's what's great about a market economy, that when a business is using resources poorly, when it's squandering resources on things when there are more important uses for those resources, the market economy exhibits that by saying, whoa, these people are losing money, and so they shut down. You don't want them to stay in operation if they're losing money. And that's why it's good that in a market economy, firms that are losing money tend to shut down. And I mean, I've been focusing a lot here on losses. It's the opposite for profits. If a firm's making really high profits, what does that mean? It means the people running that firm, the entrepreneurs, saw an opportunity. And they said, whoa, we could spend a relatively small amount of money hiring these resources away from other possible uses, combining them, and cranking out products that these customers are willing to pay us a lot of money for. And so that gap is the profit that we earn. And the fact that this opportunity was sitting here means nobody else saw it, but we did. And so we discovered a way to take the existing uses, the existing resources, change how they're used to make something new that the customers are willing to pay us more for than what they're being used for previously. Okay, so that's the idea. So you can see why there's a general presumption of thinking that profitable businesses in a market economy are actually using resources properly. So what I'm trying to get you to see here, and this is, again, going back to these innovators and entrepreneurs, is that in the real world, it's not like there's just some way to do a particular thing. Every day, businesses are constantly innovating and coming up with new ways of delivering their services, right? So Jeff Tucker, when he was at the Mises Institute, he recently went to Laissez-Faire Books, but when he was at the Mises Institute, he was kind of in charge of Mises.org. And it's not just like he just did the same thing every day. If you look at Mises.org over time, it kept evolving because Jeff had to keep thinking three and four steps ahead. Like, oh, now all of a sudden people are getting RSS feeds, and so we better do that. And, you know, he was seeing things before it became standard, and that was one of the reasons that he was really well suited for that particular thing. And the same thing with, you know, each of these other entrepreneurs, is that they saw things sooner than their competitors did, and that's why they were successful. And after they went and did it, oh, it's obvious, and then other people start imitating them. But it wasn't obvious in the beginning, and that's why, you know, so the person who does it first, if it's successful and it makes sense, that's why they tend to earn profits and they end up being wealthier than their competitors. Okay, so I talked a lot here about competition already. Let me, there was a twofold thing in the book here that I wanted to just mention. So on the one hand, what competition does is it sort of protects, and I'm putting the word protects in quotation marks there, both workers and customers. Okay, so what do I mean? So first of all, let me explain why I put that word protects in question or quotation marks. Because remember, the framework here of the analysis for all this stuff until we get to the section later, the end of the course on government intervention. Here the framework is a pure market economy where we just assume there are well-specified property rights, that everyone knows who owns what, and then we're just going to analyze what happens if people trade those things voluntarily, and what sort of things can we say about that sort of arrangement. And that's what we mean by a pure laissez-faire market economy. So in that framework, remember, every trade, so in the market, every trade is win-win. And that, again, this follows from the fact that we're assuming it's voluntary. If it's not voluntary, then it's not a trade, right? It's theft. So again, here in, if you want, in the Q&A, especially on a Saturday session office hours, we can talk about how realistic is it to suppose that a market economy could have voluntary, respect of property rights, and how do we actually enforce them, and what do we do about lawbreakers and that kind of stuff. In this course, in the textbook, we're not worrying about any of that stuff. We're just here saying, let's first assume that there's no criminals and just work through what happens in voluntary society and a peaceful market economy, and then we can later get more sophisticated and worry about what's the best way to sort of achieve that type of society or to approximate it. All right, but point is, given that we have property rights and everyone knows who owns what at stage zero, so to speak, now we're just going to look at what happens if we let people start trading voluntarily. And what kind of things can we say about that? And so remember, right off the bat, what we can say is every particular transaction is a win-win, at least going into it, that both participants expect to be better off from the trade. So now what I'm going to, over here, start talking about the ways that competition protects workers and customers. Keep in mind, even if there were no competitors for something, right? Even if it were just one business providing something and there were no other businesses providing a similar product, I'm not thereby saying, oh, so the workers and the customers there aren't protected. I mean, they are protected, and everything is fair in a sense that it's all voluntary. Okay, but you'll see there's competition adds even something more to the mix. All right, so what do I mean? That with, I think it's actually probably easier to start with customers. With customers, yeah, you've got businesses that come in and they're going to produce a product or a service for their customers. So that the businesses run by the entrepreneurs, the ones that go out and actually hire the workers and buy the resources and whatever, and they make the product or service, and then they charge a price to the customer. And what I'm suggesting here is that what competition ensures is that if there's a really big gap, if there's a big profit margin, then there's scope for some other business to come in and to do something very similar to what the first business is doing. Right, somebody else, a competitor, can see, holy cow, that entrepreneur had keen insight, saw there was a gaping hole here, an opportunity, jumped into this area, bought up a bunch of resources that were being used in inferior uses before, brought them into this new idea, this new operation, combined them and made this new product or service that the customers are paying top dollar for, and that entrepreneur is making money hand over fist. Right, that entrepreneur's monetary profits are huge right now. So I want to get a piece of that action. So how do I do it? Well, again, it's a market economy. I can't stick a gun at the person's head and say, give me some of that, or say, hey, I want to go into business with you. What do? It's got to all be voluntary. So you come in and you start hiring workers who have similar skills. You start buying resources that are comparable, and you start transforming them into a product or service that's very similar to what the first firm is doing. And then, so what do? To capture market share, you have to either make a product that's a little bit better in the eyes of the consumers, or you have to make the same type of product but charge less, or some combination. You know, if you can make a better product and charge less, well, then you're really off to a good start, assuming you could still do that and make a profit, right? So that's the way you compete against another business. Is you're it's kind of amazing that what a market economy does is it takes the most ambitious people who are just out for prestige, and they want to just, you know, beat their rivals, and they want to be the champion and be the acknowledged leaders in their field and so forth. It takes these very ambitious, perhaps ruthless people, and what does the market economy make them do? It makes them, like, sit up at night. They can't get to sleep because they're worrying about, how can I please my customers? That's what they're worried about, right? If something gets screwed up and, you know, they're producing a magazine, and then the date on the front cover's wrong as it's going out the door, and they realize it's heading out, you know, to the shipping office, and they see it, oh my gosh, stop the presses. This is ridiculous. You know, we can't send this. This is embarrassing. Our customer sees this and the date's wrong on the cover of the magazine. This is terrible. You know, this is the April issue, and it says that it's the February issue. This is terrible. You know, somebody in the Soviet Union who had a lot of power and was producing some, I don't think that person would really care much if all the workers are going to get a magazine, you know, notifying them of all the achievements of the party and the date happened to be wrong. Who cares? Workers have no idea. But it's a mortifying, terrible, embarrassing mistake if you're in a competitive market economy, because you know if you screw up, your customers might take their business elsewhere. You can't compel them to give you your money, give you their money, right? So you had these, you know, really, again, ambitious, perhaps ruthless people, and they're ultimately reduced to saying, what can we do to try to better serve our customers? And not because they're altruists, but because that's the way you make a bunch of money in a market economy. So yes, on the one hand, it sounds scary, especially to somebody who doesn't really understand the system, to say the way a market economy provides food to people is it's just a free-for-all. It's, hey, if there's a market for it, if it's profitable to go buy some land and plant some seeds and grow food and then sell it to people, well, we think somebody will do it. And that sounds scary, right? Well, gee, what if nobody does it? Then we're all going to starve. But you know, you don't get around that problem in any system. In any system, what if nobody grew any food? Then we all starve. And so the question is, how do you? What system is the most likely to not overlook what some group of people really want? And I would argue it's the market economy, because there it's open to anybody. If anybody has an idea that, oh, I think those people would really want this particular thing, where want is ultimately quantified by how much would they pay for it and then how much would it cost to produce it, well, there you go. There's an opportunity there. It doesn't mean every opportunity will be seized, but there is the incentive there that somebody, as long as one person in society has the idea and then can get the funding to go implement it, then in principle that person can go ahead and do it. Whereas any other system you can think of that doesn't have this free entry, it's not enough if just one person has the idea, right? In the Soviet Union, if one person has a great idea but can't convince the party officials, nothing happens. All right, so what protects the customers then is that there is this competition. So it's wide open. Anybody can enter the field, and then once someone is in it, the customers aren't completely at the mercy of that one supplier. So you might say, oh, yeah, people need potatoes, and so one person starts making potatoes, sure, but now he's going to charge them a ton of money for it. That's not fair. Well, okay, if he's charging ridiculously high profit margin on his potatoes, somebody else can get into the same line. So competition protects customers that way. But again, what I want to stress there is, even in the first instance, those things are all voluntary, right? Even if it's true that right now, for whatever reason, only one person in society had the foresight to get into the business of making potatoes and selling them, that person can't compel somebody else to give him money for potatoes. That even there, every single transaction is fair in the sense that both parties walk away with something they value more highly. Okay, and what about workers? Similar thing. Anytime a worker agrees to a labor contract, that, you know, there's an employer says, hey, I will give you a certain amount of money for you to sell your labor services to me, as long as it's voluntary and there's no fraud involved, then it's a win-win situation. The worker values the wages more than the leisure given up, and the employer values the labor services more than the money that was paid in wages. But beyond that, competition protects the worker in the sense that if there is a worker who's contributing, whose labor is very valuable in the sense that it delivers a lot of profit to the employer, well, then there's a margin there. There's an opportunity for some rival, some competitor to come in and offer a little bit more. And so that's what I talked about in the book with this example of the restaurant. I'm just talking about, you know, somebody who comes in and performs a service and how much the employer will pay. So let me just, you know, jot down some things that are sort of truisms, but the employer won't pay more than the employee will boost revenues. All right. So from the employer's point of view, if he's looking at this as a pure business transaction, you know, it's not like he's hiring his cousin or something like that to do a favor for the family, but he's looking at purely as a business operation in just terms of dollars and cents, why does an employer ever hire anybody? And the answer is because it's more profitable to hire workers than to not hire any workers, at least for somebody who's hiring workers. So he says, okay, well, you know, if this person came into my enterprise, then maybe my revenues would go up by a certain amount. And so now when you ask me how much would I be willing to pay this person, technically the answer would be up to, but no more than, the boost in my revenues. Strictly speaking, it would be the boost in the profitability, that if by hiring this worker to make my business continue to function properly, now if I have to go buy other resources too, then you'd have to worry about that also. But the point is, you technically, the employer asks him or herself, if I hire this worker and now run my operations with this new worker coming to work every day, how much did that actually boost my profit? Actually, why don't I even just say that? Just to be, so employer won't pay more than the employee will boost profits. And then I'll say, not considering the wage. Jeez, pen. Da-da-da. Not considering the wage. All right. So if the employer originally would make $10,000 profit, and then he realizes, oh, if I hire that person, I'll make $10,020, and this is all per hour, Well, how much would he be willing to pay that person? Up to $20 per hour. Okay, because again, they want to, there's a tendency to want to max to pay or to earn the most profit. So given that now, there's this idea that in the market economy, there's a tendency for workers to earn their marginal productivity. Right? So, here, what is marginal productivity? It's just saying what, how much profit, all things considered, does this worker deliver to the firm by showing up and working? And so then the idea is, in a market economy, there's a tendency. It doesn't mean it's going to be hit on the dollar and cent perfectly, but there's a tendency. If a worker is bringing $20 per hour and more profit, not considering the wage, to the employer is going to have a tendency to pay up to $20 to that worker, because again, a competition. Suppose the worker is delivering $20 in extra profit, not considering the wage, and the employer only pays that worker $10 an hour. Well, then that means that there's a comparable firm out there that has a similar, you know, niche for that particular worker. That business person, that entrepreneur sees an opportunity. Says, wait a minute, if I paid this worker $11 an hour, and he came and worked for me and boost my profits, not counting the wage, by 20, well, then I'm still netting a $9 increase in my total profits from doing that. So since I have a tendency to want to maximize my profits, why wouldn't I do that? And I just made myself $9 more profit by that transaction. Okay, so that bidding process in principle could happen. And the only way it would stop is when the worker is being paid close to what he or she is delivering to the firm. So that's the sense in which competition protects the workers. So yes, even with no competition from some comparable firm where there's a similar job available, workers are always protected in a market economy in the sense that they're not slaves. Everything they agree to do is voluntary. But there's a refined sense of protection where if you are getting paid far less than what you're actually delivering to the bottom line, well, then there's this huge opportunity for some rival firm to come in and offer you more. And, of course, you can speed it up yourself. If you're a worker and you think you're getting so-called underpaid, you can go out and actively try to get a better job. Right, so you don't have to just sit back and hope you get discovered. You can take active steps to remedy the situation too. But the point is, it's not like you have to convince someone else to have mercy on you or to pity you. In a market economy, competitive forces make it in the personal financial interest of other entrepreneurs to give you more pay if you really are being so-called underpaid. Okay, saving and investment. Let me just see here. Okay, good. I see we got questions building up. So, yeah, I think tonight's lecture I will be able to end on the early side with a formal lecture, and then I'll spend a lot of time answering your questions because I know I haven't been too good about having time at the end of the previous lectures. So tonight we'll try to do things the other way and go extra long on the questions. Okay, so I'm looking now at slide Roman numeral 2, saving and investment. We have already talked about this in the context of Robinson Crusoe. Remember, there we went over these definitions of things in the context of Robinson Crusoe. And they had their sort of, you know, physical manifestations there. That even without money, this is what it would mean to talk about income and consumption and saving and investment, right? So Crusoe realized, I can, with my bare hands, get so many coconuts per day and eat them, and so that's the sense in, you know, which I would be consuming them, and what would my income be? Well, that would be, how many coconuts can I eat per day? And then what would saving be? Oh, it would mean not consuming as many coconuts per day as I physically could if I wanted to, but, you know, restraining myself. And then the investment was devoting some of his labor time to not directly satisfying his present desires by grabbing coconuts with his bare hands, but instead, you know, building the long pole. And that was, he was investing in his future income, because he realized, if I build this pole, once it's finished, my labor will be much more productive. And so there he was taking his resources and pumping them into a project that wouldn't pay off immediately, but it would pay off in the future. Okay, so again, even with Robinson Crusoe, we saw the interaction of these concepts. And the crucial thing was, we saw if Crusoe had the discipline, the willpower to save and to invest, he could increase his future income and hence his future consumption, right? So his standard of living could increase over time just working through the mechanism of saving and investment. So it wasn't merely that Crusoe, if he has a really good idea and then and figures out, oh, you know what, I've been climbing the trees to get the coconuts, but instead, if I perfect this strange call that I can do with my voice, I can get all these monkeys to come and just start throwing coconuts at me. You know, I somehow get the monkeys to think I'm an invader and they start throwing coconuts at me, but that's great because I just then pick the coconuts up off the ground. You know, if he came up with that, that would be clever, and all of a sudden his income would be much higher and his consumption would be much higher, right? But that wouldn't really be saving an investment. That would just be like a sudden change in technology, I guess. It's that his labor all of a sudden would be more productive because of that boom, that brilliant idea he had. And that's great. I'm not knocking that. But I'm saying that's a different thing from him knowing from day one about, you know, yeah, I could, if I really wanted to, get a bunch of vines and get those sticks and sharpen them and put them together. But, man, that would take a lot of effort and time. And so how could I do that? Well, I could build up a stockpile of coconuts, and then once I had that stockpile in hand, then I could devote a day or two to building that stick, and I'd eat, you know, draw down the coconuts that I had previously accumulated in my savings. Okay, so you see how that's, there's a different thing there. So my point is, with Crusoe, even in that simple world, there's a difference between him getting a higher standard of living because he had a great idea and in a sense, you know, improved his technology, versus him working with the same mental framework and his understanding of how nature works and what he could do in terms of transforming his environment, but then realizing within those constraints and the trade-offs involved that, well, if I'm willing to postpone immediate gratification, I can make myself permanently better off, right? So there are those benefits of in the long run. So there's short-term pain, long-term gain from saving and then investment, even for Crusoe. But so now what we're going to do is talk about those same concepts, but in the context of people and businesses in an economy with millions of people, and in particular that use money. Okay, so how would we sort of update our definitions there? Well, consumption here means the money spent on immediate gratification. All right. and these phrases might not line up perfectly with what I say in a textbook, obviously. This is more me just trying to motivate this for this oral lecture here. So that's what consumption would mean in a context of where there's money involved. And let me be clear, there's nothing pejorative in that sense, in that term consumption. And the term immediate, a lot of times people might say, oh, immediate gratification, like it's a bad thing. Well, you have to, whenever you enjoy something, it's in the present, right? It would be ridiculous to say, oh, you should always defer gratification. You know, don't ever experience immediate gratification. Always postpone it because it'll be better. Well, then you would never get to consume, right? If you said, oh, no, don't enjoy that now, wait, well, then what happens when you wait? And then, you know, it's the future. At that point, it's now the present. And so at some point, if you're ever going to consume, you have to consume in the present, if you get what I'm saying, right? So immediate gratification is not a bad thing per se, and nor does it mean something that's sort of hedonist, right? Consumption can mean going to the opera. Consumption can mean buying a work of art. So it doesn't mean that's just, oh, going to a Taco Bell or, you know, buying a fancy race car because you like to drive around or whatever and get a thrill. Consumption includes those things, but it also includes real refined sort of, you know, highbrow things as well. What makes it consumption is if it's money that you're spending for the purposes of directly satisfying your desires in the present. Okay? So if we know what consumption is, then income actually is easier to define. So that is, that's not what I want to do. Oops, I'm picking the wrong thing, sorry. Income is how much money you could consume without reducing wealth. And again, I don't remember the exact way I phrased it in the book. Another way of saying it is you could say your income is how much money you could spend on consumption without making yourself poor. You could say that too. Or income is how much money you could spend on consumption while maintaining your current level of wealth. Okay, so these are all equivalent ways of saying it. Andrea, I noticed in the comments is saying, or without going into debt. That's close, but it's not quite right, because what if I start out and I have $100,000 in the bank and I get a paycheck of $50,000, but I consume $60,000? Well, then what ends up happening is I have to take out $10,000 from my bank account to cover that shortfall. So when all is said and done, I'm not in debt. I don't owe anybody any money, but I consumed more than my income, right? Because I started out with $100,000 in the bank, and then I ended up with only $90,000 in the bank. So there, I lived beyond my means, but yet I didn't actually go into debt. It's what happened is I reduced my wealth. Okay, so you're right, especially if I started out with nothing and I wanted to consume more than my income, I would have to go into debt. But I'm just saying that it's not only can it be a case where you owe people money, it could be that you have fewer assets than you did in the beginning. And so that also would be living beyond your means. Okay. So, OK, Okay, we got those two out of the way. So then what would saving be? Saving is income minus consumption. Right, so in other words, if you consume less than your income, that difference is savings. Or another way of putting it is you have your income, you can consume some of it and save the rest. Right? So this is all, don't overthink this. This is all standard stuff. But I'm trying to just give it a little bit of a formal definition so you can see how it is the monetary analog of what Crusoe was doing with physical stuff. And then investment is spending money in the hope of boosting, that's the up arrow, future income. Okay, so investment is spending money now in the hope of boosting future income. Okay, this frugal Freddy versus prodigal Paul, I don't think it's a good use of our time for me to go over that right now. But if you haven't read the chapter yet, I encourage you to read it and make sure you go over that, those numerical examples. If you're a business person, you know that's not going to be a big. You already know that stuff. But for those of you who are, you know, homeschoolers or whatever, and you're in junior high or something like that, I think you should look over those numbers. And the thing I want you to realize is that anyone can be a millionaire. If you save enough, all right? So I specifically chose the numbers in the example to show the difference between somebody who saves a high fraction of his income, he was Frugal Freddy, to contrast it with Prodigal Paul, right? So they start out with the same paycheck. They had the same income in the beginning, and the difference is just that Frugal Freddy saves a lot more. And so then what ends up happening is, over time, his income grows. Not because he gets more from his employer, but because as he saves, he's building up his wealth. He's building up these other financial assets. They're his property, and they in turn generate an income for him as well. And so I think in the example, it was just, I assume he had money in a bank account that was paying a set rate of interest. And anyway, I just walked through the numbers. You could see quite clearly where the income is coming from those assets to supplement his paycheck from his employer. So you can see what ends up happening is, in the beginning, Frugal Freddy has a lower standard of living than Prodigal Paul does, right? Because Freddy is saving more. So that means he has to spend less on immediate enjoyment. So he doesn't get to go out to restaurants as much. He doesn't have as nice a car. Maybe his house isn't as fancy. So looking at Frugal Freddy and Prodigal Paul in the first few years, it looks like Prodigal Paul has a better life. He's a more fun guy to be around. But you track him over time, and eventually Freddy has a higher standard of living. Even though throughout the whole thing, he maintains that higher fraction of saving, what ends up happening is because he saves more, his income grows more quickly. So even though he consumes a smaller fraction of his income, the pie grows more quickly, so that even that, you know, that smaller percentage times the size of his income ends up yielding a bigger number for his consumption than Prodigal Paul, who has a higher percentage multiplied by his income in terms of what he consumes each year, but his income, the base, grows more slowly. So that's one thing to see. So there's that trade-off. The same trade-off we saw with Crusoe happens with these guys in terms of dollars and cents. And then beyond that, I show how, you know, a responsible individual provides for his retirement. That he says, okay, I'm going to be, you know, I'm earning a paycheck from my employer for a certain number of years. At some point, I'm either going to be incapable or unwilling to sell my labor services for money. And so if I don't want to be a burden on my family or the church or, you know, the government, if we're in the real world, I want to, at that point, have enough financial assets that are throwing off enough income to support me, or at the very least, that I can start drawing down so that I'm not in debt by the time I die. All right, so it's okay to be living beyond your means to consume more than your income, as long as you've built up a bunch of wealth. And then you can just, you know, start eating through that wealth as long as you time it right and you don't die or you don't live too long, put it that way, then, you know, that's an issue too. Okay, and of course, in the real world, a lot of people don't want to die right when they burn the last cent to their name. They want to have a big estate left over to then give to their heirs or give to charities and so forth. All right, so it's a fairly standard thing, but you should see that at some point while you're still young. And that's why I put that in the book, is to make sure people realize anybody can be a millionaire. That anybody can't be a millionaire by the time you're 27, unless, you know, you have a really great idea or you have some rare skill, like you're a star basketball player. But the point is, anybody can have accumulated $1 million in wealth and then some by their 50s, if even with a regular paying job, if you saved a lot. And the text, of course, also, there's, I don't assume taxes. So that's a thing that will kill you in the real world. Okay, I think this is the last slide for tonight, and then I'll shift over to the Q&A. Physical counterpart, what do I mean here? What I'm trying to get you to see is that I don't know how to put this, combine the Crusoe and the last scenario. Okay, what do I mean? That with Crusoe, I walked you through a physical thing where somebody, you know, he realized, oh, if I postpone potential consumption, if I live below my means for a few days and invest in capital goods, that's what that stick was, remember, that long pole, then I can boost my future income and end up having a permanently higher standard of living measured in terms of how many coconuts per day can I consume. And then I just showed you with Frugal Freddy and Prodigal Paul how, if you're just looking at it in terms of a spreadsheet with numbers, dollars and cents, that, oh yeah, if I'm willing to save more early on in my life with a positive rate of interest, then my income grows more quickly than this other guy's does. And so then even with my lower fraction of, or my lower percentage of consumption, my income grows so much quicker that eventually I have a higher standard of living, but I'm consuming more year after year than the other guy. I'm going out to fancier restaurants. I have a nicer car, even though I save more at some point. All right? And so what I want you to see is those are connected. It's not like they're just different things. What happened with Crusoe does happen in a modern market economy. It's just that money helps coordinate everything and helps people plan and helps it all come together, since there's millions of people involved. Where it was Crusoe, it wasn't that complicated. He was the only person on the island. Everything was at his disposal, and it was just a matter of trading off coconuts today versus coconuts tomorrow. With a modern market economy, things are a lot more complex. And if you want to consume less today to provide for your retirement years, really kind of what you're doing is you're abstaining from going out to a restaurant today so that 60 years from now you can take a cruise to the Bahamas. right? And so that's a very complicated thing. Whereas with Crusoe, it was a lot easier. He just realized, oh, if I don't eat all the coconuts today, then that will allow me to start making a stick so I can knock down the, you know, that's not too complicated. But to understand physically what's the trade-off involved between me not going out and getting steak tonight instead of eating a bologna sandwich, and then with that savings, investing it in some financial asset, and then 60 years from now, taking those accumulated earnings and buying a trip to the Bahamas, then, you know, that's, it's not obvious what me eating a bologna sandwich today has to do with there being a cruise ship available 60 years from now to take me to the Bahamas. But yet, those things are related in the grand scheme, and that's what a market does. So, just very quickly, how did that work? Because what ends up happening is when people save more, it frees up real resources to make capital goods. And that's a crucial thing to realize. Right, so at any given time, we've got all these resources at our disposal, and we can combine them in various ways to make different types of goods and services. And if people are willing to defer consumption, right, if families, as a general rule, don't spend as much going out to dinner and don't spend as much on Ferraris and plasma screen TVs and so on, and instead they save more, what happens? Well, yeah, the restaurants see their business drop. Like, oh, man, not as many people are coming out to eat, so they start suffering losses, so they shut down. They lay off waiters and waitresses, and they lay off the cooks, and they stop, you know, buying the raw meat, whatever they were using to serve steaks to everybody. And it frees up those resources. Now there's a bunch of unemployed people. But what ends up happening is, if things are coordinated properly, those resources get absorbed in areas that are making capital goods. So they make tools and equipment and other things that enhance the productivity of the workers. And so what really happens is like the economy just sort of retools or reorients itself, and instead of cranking out stuff for immediate enjoyments, in a sense we're more making things to get ready for making consumer goods down the road. And so it's analogous to what happens with Crusoe, that instead of him focusing on stuffing as many coconuts in his face as possible today, he does something that doesn't directly benefit him today, but that will be very useful in the future. And so that's kind of what the economy as a whole does, or is capable of doing, when people save more. Right, so they abstain from consuming things that bring present immediate enjoyment. And so given that there's scarcity, the fact that now we've sort of loosened up on how much consumption we want today gives us more options. And now that frees up some of those resources that can be deployed to making things that enhance our future productivity. So that saving and investment is one of the major vehicles for why humans tend to have a constantly increasing standard of living. So when we say, why is it that today, in the year 2012, we have a much higher standard of living than our great-grandparents did in the year 1912, 100 years ago, most people, when you ask them that, are going to say, oh, it's because of, you know, inventions, that somebody figured out how to make computers, and somebody figured out how to, you know, the Model T and all this other stuff. And that stuff's all true, but also laid on top of that is saving and investment. So it's a two-pronged thing. Yeah, humans are always coming up with good ideas, more efficient ways of doing something. But even if we had just locked in our knowledge of how the world worked back in 1912, and nobody ever had a really great idea ever again, we would still have a higher standard of living now than we did back then, because people save and invest, even using known technologies. So one way of putting it is, if all of us with our brilliant ideas and knowledge of how the world works right now if all of a sudden all the machines and tools disappeared and we had to start from scratch with our bare hands, we would be really poor for a long time. So that shows it's not merely having the knowledge of how the world works, it's also having the tools and equipment to work with, to augment our bare labor. And it takes a long time to build that stuff up. And so right now, we're the beneficiaries, not just of all the technological, you know, mental innovations of the last few thousand years that humans have accumulated, but we're also the beneficiaries of the physical equipment and tools that our ancestors have passed along over the generations. Okay, I went longer than I meant to there. Let me spend the remaining time going over your questions. Jared says, how would you counter the argument that our complicated modern infrastructure is unsustainable without the aid of government and taxes? Can the market economy and entrepreneurship account for every facet of our society without government intervention? Well, I would say yes, it can. And some people would say, oh, that's so unscientific of you. You're just being dogmatic. How can you know that? You know, how can you make such a sweeping generalization? Well, I have yet to see a specific thing that government does well. Everything the government does, it botches. You know, like roads, for example. Roads are terrible. They're death traps, right? If, like Walter Block likes to say, you know, he cites the statistic of how many people die on government roads each year, and he said, you know, if private business had that record, people would be clamoring for the government to take it over and say, oh my gosh, look at all these deaths. But since the government does it, you know, we just say, oh yeah, you should be careful when you drive because you can get killed. And, you know, no one considers that the road design and arrangement and so forth might play a lot in those outcomes. So, I mean, just generally speaking, there's a lot of institutional systematic reasons to think the market economy better provides goods and services than the government. So we're getting a little bit ahead of ourselves because we're supposed to talk about government intervention in a few chapters. But like I said, here, today's lecture, I sort of went over the general mechanisms by which a market economy takes goods and services and makes things that consumers want. So generally speaking, without talking about specific products and services, if there's a way to do it better, the market economy is the best equipped to discover it. It's open to anybody. So it doesn't mean at any given time the market's doing it right. But what it means is if there is a better way to do it, so that you think, oh, if the government came in, they could do it better, well, that improvement is also open to the individual entrepreneurs. If a politician's smart enough to realize, oh, there's a better way to do it, so is an individual entrepreneur. Okay. Sanmay says, can an employee of a company be called an entrepreneur since he offers his services to the employer for a particular amount of money? Okay, an employee can be called an entrepreneur, but not for the reason you say. Okay, so the sense in which an employee is an entrepreneur is that in a sense he's taking... Yeah, how can I put it? Remember, what the entrepreneur does is sort of looks out at the situation and tries to perceive opportunities. And so you as an employee, in a sense, what you're doing is you're looking at the scene and you're trying to assess what's the best use of my resource, which is my human labor. And you could try to open a business yourself, or you could just go work for somebody else. So you're being entrepreneurial in the sense that you decided right now the best thing for me to do, the best opportunity I perceive, my role in the division of labor, is to go sell my labor services to this person over here in exchange for a fixed amount of money per hour, plus, you know, whatever benefits I get or whatever. But as opposed to, you know, me opening up a hardware store. So there is an entrepreneurial element involved on the part of everybody. Just like if you're a farmer and you're growing, you know, and you're selling tomatoes to somebody, I mean, you have to decide what crops to plant and so on. And then even the decision of you to sell them I mean, maybe you should keep it off the market. Maybe the price of tomatoes is going to go up tomorrow, and you're going to be slapping yourself saying, oh, I wish I hadn't sold them today. Right? So any transaction you engage in, you're trying to anticipate the future and see what's the best thing for me to do right now based on my expectations. So everything is entrepreneurial in that sense. But I think, well, anyway, that's my answer. So I'm thinking, yes, you're right. There is a sense in which even the employee is entrepreneurial, but I don't think it's quite for the reason you're saying. Okay, Jared asks, when you say that profitable entrepreneurs may be ruthless, would it be true to say that capitalism fosters or rewards ruthlessness? Well, we would have to be more specific about what do we mean by ruthless. If ruthless means you're willing to do things that other people would be afraid to do, then I don't think, no, I mean, I'll tell you what the situation is, then you can decide whether you think it rewards it or not. I think it's what it really rewards is somebody's ability to earn profits, to outcompete their competitors. So to the extent that a real, you know, soft-spoken person who's afraid to hurt someone's feelings or who doesn't like people saying bad things about them, who doesn't like to get yelled at, that sort of person probably is not going to be able to lead a company of 50,000 employees and to have a world wide operation going on. So I think capitalism, you could say, but it's not rewarding someone for ruthlessness per se, right? So if you're ruthless and you make horrible business decisions, well then no, capitalism doesn't reward that. So it's not that capitalism rewards ruthlessness, it's that what capitalism does reward or select for, if you will, in many people might be correlated with ruthlessness, put it that way. Okay, Jared asks, how big of a hindrance to a market economy or entrepreneurship are copyright laws? Could a copyright be considered a form of monopoly that distorts the market? Or patents, he then clarifies. Yeah, so this is an area where my own views have changed since reading the work of Stephen Kinsella. So let me just type that out. If you're interested in this stuff, Stephen Kinsella had a classic thing called Against IP, where IP stands for intellectual property. Or maybe the formal title is Against Intellectual Property. I don't remember exactly. So, and he's got other stuff too, but if you just Google that, then you can find that and start following the references and so forth. So just for people who have no idea what we're talking about here, so we're describing here a market economy and profits and losses and the voluntary exchange of property titles, and we're being a little bit vague about how are those things defined and what sorts of things count as property rights. So we all have in mind that, oh, if I have a bunch of gold coins in my hand, well, that's property, and my labor is property that I can sell to other people. But, you know, can somebody own the word the? Right? Can I own sunshine? Can I own oxygen? Can I own the use of the phrase, let's get ready to rumble? Okay, so the point is the people have disagreements about what sorts of things can be owned in a market economy. You know, if I write a book, is that book mine? What does that even mean? Sure, the physical thing, if it's in my house and I made it with my book, that's mine, but what if I assemble the stuff and then I write what we know of as A Tale of Two Cities, and then I try to sell it to somebody else? Is that okay? Or pick, I don't know if that's in the public domain. Pick something newer if that's in the public domain. You know, some novel, some John Grisham novel. What if I type it up on my computer and print it out and bind it, and then I start going around selling that thing to people? I own the paper, and there's no dispute about that, but does John Grisham own the story? And so these are all issues that are sort of philosophically interesting and you need to answer in the real world. If you're going to have a market economy where people exchange property rights, you need to know what sort of things can be owned by people and what sort of things does it not make sense to talk about being owned. What if you discover a mathematical formula, like a theorem? Can I then charge other mathematicians before they use it? That seems crazy to us. But yet, if I discover a way to make a drug that cures cancer, a lot of people think it's perfectly fine for me to charge other pharmaceutical companies before they can manufacture it. Right? So that's sort of an odd thing there, that it seems crazy. Oh, like you could own a mathematical theorem. No, you can't. But a lot of people think it's right to say you can own the formula for synthesizing a drug, even though they're both intellectual things. So so that's kind of stuff Stephen Kinsella gets into. So the quick answer, Jared, to your question is, I think it's a very big hindrance the way in practice governments enforce that stuff, and I think it completely distorts the way the markets would evolve, particularly in those areas that are heavily influenced by IP law. So, music and software and stuff like that, movies, I think those markets would look a lot different if you didn't have government IP enforcement. But that's kind of beyond the scope of this class. Okay, hang on, let me just see how many questions we got. Okay, I think I can answer these. Karen says, why do we define the income of an individual in terms of spending instead of the revenues like an organization? Oh. Well, notice, I'm not. It was potential spending, if you will. Right, the income of the individual was how much could you consume, how much could you spend on consumption without reducing your wealth. So there, it isn't actually measuring how much did you spend, it's just saying how much could you have. And so I don't know if that clears up the question. The reason it's a little bit tricky, Karen, is that you don't want to just say your income as an individual is how much money comes in the door. Because if I sell my house, I have a bunch of cash that comes in, but that's not income. If I go and spend all that on consumption, I consumed a lot of wealth. I made myself poorer by doing that. So that's why I didn't want to say your income is how much money comes in a month or whatever the time frame is. Okay, Jared says, in your example of people saving money resulting in restaurant layoffs, you said if things are coordinated correctly, the market readjusts. What would be an example of things not being coordinated correctly? Well, what I mean there is what people are trying to do, and an example I cited, is people are thinking, like if they're looking at their monthly budget and they're trying to have savings objectives and they want to say, okay, we want to send the kid to college. And so we want to start saving now. They say you just had a kid. And you say, okay, let's start putting away money each month so that by the time the kid's 18, we have whatever, $30,000 saved up there really to help fund college, and we'll have the kid either get a scholarship or get a job to pay for the rest of it. So how are they going to build up that $30,000? Well, we're going to cut back. We're going to stop going out to eat so much. We're not going to take a vacation to a real fancy place. We're going to go to someplace cheaper. So really what you're doing in the grand scheme is you're saying we want the market economy, instead of producing, so we want to produce fewer restaurant meals and fewer plane trips to the Bermuda Triangle, or Bahamas or whatever, and have a bus trip to a more low-budget place. And then 30 years or 18 years from now, we want there to be room at the college for our child to go there. And so we need there to be enough professors trained in the interim so that they can be hired by the college to teach. And did it, so you see, I'm saying that's a very complicated thing. So if all of a sudden everybody just drastically changed their preferences overnight, if all of a sudden most of the people woke up in one day and just said, I'm going to start saving, instead of saving 5% of my income, I'm going to start saving 85% of my income. And everyone just, boom, stopped going to restaurants altogether. They just started eating bologna sandwiches. The sales of Ferraris dropped down to zero, and so on. You know, no one bought any more plasma screen TVs. Everyone just started wearing really simple clothing and so forth, because everybody had this idea that when I turn 55, I want to take a shuttle trip to Mars. That's what I'm saving up for. You know, entrepreneurs might not get that message for a while. You know, so if everybody, if we're completely coordinated, yeah, the resources on a dime, you know, the restaurant industry would have seen that coming for decades and would have timed it just perfectly that, you know, that their lease would have run out and they would have had contracts with their waiters and so forth to say the last day you're going to be working is next Tuesday, because on Wednesday everyone's going to stop going out to eat. You see, so if everybody saw everything coming and knew there was going to be that massive change in preferences, then the market would just seamlessly shift to do things optimally, whereas in the real world, such a huge change in what the consumers wanted would catch everybody by surprise, and the entrepreneurs would say, oh my gosh, I wouldn't have just opened that new restaurant if I realized everyone's going to stop going out to dinner next week forever or until they go to Mars, right? And so that's what I mean, that this coordination mismatch of if there were drastic changes in preferences and how people wanted to time stuff. Okay, I got to go, guys, and so are you. So thanks for tuning in, and I will see some of you on Saturday.